1320 AM, W248 DE, Wisconsin Rapids, and always streaming on the Civic Media app.
CBS News Special Report. Taking to the stage on the second night of the Republican National Convention, former U.N. Ambassador Nikki Haley tells the crowd,
"I'm here tonight because we have a country to save. And a unified Republican Party is essential for saving her."
Our Matt Piper at the convention says of a second appearance by former President Donald Trump.
He's wearing a blue tie. Everyone is on their feet clapping. He was announced here just ahead of a video that played of YMCA, where it was just a loop of him dancing on stages over the last year or so.
As the investigation continues into this weekend's assassination attempt on Trump, CBS's Meg Oliver reports.
The Department of Homeland Security and the FBI have issued a bulletin to law enforcement nationwide warning that violent extremists could try to retaliate at election events over the next few months.
CBS News Special Report, I'm Jennifer Kuiper.
Seth here, host of Over the Back Fence. We're on the air live every Saturday from 11 a.m. to 12 p.m., taking your calls to buy or sell, talk local events, or whatever, only on WFHR.
News. I'm Savannah Tomei Olson. Here's what Wisconsin needs to know. City leaders and Republican officials promised Milwaukee businesses would get big boosts during the Republican National Convention. But so far, some restaurants and shops say it's been pretty slow. That may be because attendees are on a tight schedule. Delegate Stephanie Susek.
We were kind of, you know, tied up having to be at the convention hall. And so we're looking forward to some more flexibility in the next few days to go out and, you know, just be part of the community and get out to different places.
That schedule is really keeping people busy at Fiserv. Civic Media has a team at the convention. We'll be there all week. And this is such sad news from Door County. Two kids, a 3-year-old and a 5-year-old, died when the sailboat they were on capsized near Chambers Island. Officials are still searching for their dad, 32-year-old Bill Salnick of Little Swamp. The Door County Sheriff's Office says they'll keep searching until they find him. And that's what you need to know. I'm Savannah Tomei Olson, Civic Media News.
The impact of a meal goes well beyond feeding our bodies, because feeling full can sound like this.
How did the interview go?
I did it! I got the job! I can't believe it!
And like this.
Mom, I got first place at the science fair with my volcano project!
That's amazing, sweetie. Congratulations!
Because when people are fed, futures are nourished, and everyone deserves to live a full life. Join the movement to end hunger at feedingamerica.org/act now. Brought to you by Feeding America and the Ad Council.
You're listening to locally grown radio, WFHR, home for Matt Nair on air.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
It's time for the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is the voice of the working class, Rick Smith.
And welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks so much for being here today on the big program. Lots to get to. Lots to talk about. Looks like Trump's got a VP going to stand next to him. Behind him, in front of him, who knows. Interestingly enough, the first guy to call him Hitler. I'm not making this up. The first person to call Donald Trump Hitler was J.D. Vance. In fact, J.D. Vance once said that Trump was unfit for our highest national office, and admitted that he didn't vote for Donald Trump in 2016. So it's interesting that this is the guy that Donald Trump has chosen. Now, understand, it's for reasons, because he's basically sold his soul. He's in. He's the Mike Pence of this election cycle. And I would argue he's the guy, he's the embodiment of Jay Gould's "I could pay half the working class to murder the other half." Because look, he's a corporate shill. He is most certainly on the side of corporate power. That's the reality, and he's going to sell workers out to corporate America at every opportunity. So the idea that this ticket, Donald Trump, a billionaire, and the hillbilly elegy guy or effigy guy, somehow that's going to be a pro worker, pro union ticket is kind of weird. Now you look at his voting record, and again, you go back to not what they say, what they do. J.D. Vance walked on a picket line in Toledo with the UAW. his voting record goes, why are you there? Other than it's PR. It's imagery. His voting record is terrible. In fact, you know, he has been accused of calling auto workers fat and lazy and going down this whole rabbit hole of basically workers in general. And the more I think about J.D. Vance as the vice presidential pick, the more I go, yeah, I don't know that he's going to be all that helpful. Ohio was going to go to Trump anyway. I don't think that was ever on the ballot. He has said that he will do the things that Mike Pence wouldn't do. So that's one of those things where you go, okay, now understand who you're voting for. If we get into a scenario where, you know, things are up in the air. This is a guy who has said he's not going to certify the elections. He's not going to do the right. He's going to do what Trump tells him to do. He's not going to do what's in the best interest of the country, of the Constitution. He's going to do what he's supposed to do to the guy he sold his soul for. Here's a guy who's called for criminal investigations into a reporter over at the Washington Post who wrote a bad piece on Donald Trump. So we're gonna start locking up reporters. And the big one for working people, the thing that you should be paying attention to, and one of the things that drew me to Project 2025 right from the very beginning was this idea that they're going to use this thing called Schedule F to go in and fire all the federal employees, you know, everyone from top to bottom, and replace them with good loyalists, with good patronage hires, people who may not be qualified for the job, but have kissed their leader's ring. And understand, you have J.D. Vance, who's all on board with firing what he called mid-level bureaucrats and replacing them with, quote-unquote, our people. You know, the patronage folks. And it got me to thinking that, you know, look, you know, this guy is part of that machine that wants to undo the 20th century. This is part of that machine that wants to continue to move the pendulum of power to the wealthy and away from working people because, hey, can't get those workers too uppity. And then we've got to use the socialists are coming. And look, there's a new talking point out there. I happened to catch a video of Steve Forbes, you know, the billionaire Steve Forbes, who was running around screaming, we need a flat tax. We need a flat tax. You know, a flat tax that he pays less and you pay more. Yeah, that flat tax. He's out there talking about the new socialism because, you know, socialism just isn't scary enough. We've got to have new socialism. The old socialism was, you know, those people want to take over the factories. They want to run everything. They want to control the factors of production. That's the old socialism. He's like, no, they don't want to do that. They don't want to take the stuff. They just want to regulate it. They want to regulate it. So regulations are really the new socialism, the new communism. It's that regulationism. And, you know, healthcare, you know, having regulations in there, no. Manufacturing, no. No safety, no. No environment, no. And look, you know, the Project 2025 people, if you read their forms, are all on board with that. You know, corporate America will do what's in their best interest. And their best interest is making profit. They don't care about the environment or their employees. Bottom line is making the rich richer. And, you know, I've gotten some blowback as I've said, look, this Republican Party is not they're not the Republicans. You know, I sometimes say, well, you have a problem with talking to Republicans. I don't, not Republican voters. The people who are in Milwaukee, they have shown us that they're fascists. And I don't say that lightly. These are the people who were running around years ago saying, we don't care about people who sign the back of a check. We only care about people who sign the front of a check. And recently I had someone throw out at me that, you know, unions represent everyone. And I'm going, I don't know. I agree with that. Unions represent all workers, but the crowd sitting in those seats at the RNC, you know, the people who hate unions, I don't know that the unions should be representing them. There's a division. I've had someone explain to me or try to explain to me that unions and corporations don't have differences, that there isn't a break of light between their interests. And I go, no, I think there's a massive break. Corporate America wants to squeeze every minute of labor out of you and get every penny of profit they can possibly squeeze out of every bit of sweat, blood, and tears they can get from you, and then line their own pockets. Workers want to be able to support their families. They want to get health care. They want to get retirement security. They want to be able to put food on the table, a roof over their head. They got interests over here that are in opposition to what the corporations want. Corporations want cheap labor. Corporations want not to have to deal with any headaches from their workforce, and they want them disposable. You know, like any machine, we'll use you when we need you, and then out into the cold. So this idea that, you know, unions represent everyone, no, they represent workers. And what the folks who are sitting in that convention hall, that we're watching this political theater, these are not people who care about workers. They're saying all the nice things. They've given, you know, platforms to the Teamsters president. But do they really, through their actions, really care? Now, you know, you look at what they're talking about in the Project 2025, little manifesto they've got going on. It's all about neutering labor's power. It's all about making it harder to organize. It's all about making it harder to represent workers. It's all about changing the system to where we can offer other avenues outside of unions to where workers can express their feelings. Doesn't mean you're going to get any results, but you'll be able to express your feelings. And you go, we've done this before. They were called company unions. And in the old days, we ruled those unconstitutional. We've now got a court. Be very afraid. That can bring some of this stuff in. They want to pass right to work. They want to destroy overtime. They want to destroy everything that the working class was built on that brought them prosperity. What they want is a massive redistribution of wealth. And that is the reality. We are in a moment of which side are you on? We are in a moment where the choices are very, very clear. If you work for a living, the people sitting in Milwaukee as we speak, they don't have your interests at heart. They're talking about destroying Medicare, destroying Medicaid, Social Security, the social safety net. They have an ideology that is of a Wild West scenario that's never been. A pure, perfect capitalist system with no intervention from corporation, from government or unions or any of that. Just pure competition, which eventually leads to monopoly and, well, corporate dominance, which is what they want. And not just in, you know, sneakers and cars, but in education and in healthcare and all of the things that we as working people desperately, desperately need. So the more I look at this Project 2025, this thing that they've put out for us to actually look at, the more frightful we should be. Because they're telling us out loud, we're coming for you. We are going to fundamentally change this country in ways that you, one, can't imagine, and are do irreparable harm to workers and their families. Scary stuff. I want to hear your thoughts. Email me, Rick at RickSmithShow.com. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, Jess Piper is going to be here from Blue, Missouri. Stick around.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors, the American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So the year was 1960. This date in 1960, you had seven black kids, high school students, and a college student who had the audacity, the unmitigated gall to go into a Greenville, South Carolina county public library and read books and read magazines. Sitting off to the side quietly, just sitting there, just flipping pages, reading. Librarian, not happy. Calls the police. The police come and arrest these students, put them in jail. Why? They were reading while black. Now, you go, well, why does that matter today? We don't have those problems today. I got to tell you, the way we're censoring content and the way there are bad books, I do foresee a moment down the road where the right gets their way and we start locking people up for what they're reading in the county public library. It is disgraceful. Anyway, on the backdrop of all this, you've got the RNC convention, the little political theater show game, the Project 2025 thing that the Heritage Foundation had put out, kind of to make this kind of stuff great again, keeping people in line. And education, right on the chopping block in both areas. And here to share some thoughts on the attack on public education, I've asked our good friend Jess Piper to come talk with us. She's the executive director of Blue Missouri. Her website, thedirtroaddemocrat.com. Jess, thanks for taking time for us.
Thank you. Thanks for talking about this. It's really important. I was a teacher for 16 years. I live in Missouri. We've been running the pilot for Project 2025 for a really long time. So opening this document, I was like, yep, at least they said the quiet part, right?
No, they're not saying the quiet part, Jess. They're screaming it.
I know. And there's no quiet part anymore. They're absolutely fine saying it out loud. But the document is over 900 pages, but the education part is only 44. And it's a great place for people to go in and just dig in. And the very first quote was from Milton Friedman, and that should scare the pants off of everybody because, he's the guy who created school vouchers so that white kids wouldn't have to go to school with black kids. Goes all the way back to Brown v. Board. They're serious about this. Milton Friedman said that every kid deserves a rudimentary education from the state. And then after that, if you can't pay for it, sorry.
You're right? On your own. Jess, yeah. One of the things that I've been saying for years, and this is not new, my audience knows I've been saying it all this long, the right wants to do to K-12 education what they've been able to do to higher education. It's now a commodity. It's now, you got to have skin in the game to get it. It's no longer part of the commons. It's no longer for the common good. It's no longer for a well-educated, well-informed citizenry. No, it's a commodity to be purchased. And what it appears that they want to do is exactly what they did with higher ed. So that if your fifth grader wants to go on to sixth or finish high school, they're going to have to take out huge loans. And if you can't afford those huge loans, well, there's always cheap labor to be done.
Right. And Betsy DeVos was very clear about this when she was asked by a reporter, how does this work in rural areas? Because we don't have choice. There's no choice. The closest choice school to me is 56 miles one way, and it's Catholic. By the way, I'm not Catholic. That's a little problematic. But Betsy DeVos was asked, what does this look like in rural spaces? And she says, well, I think that rural kids could listen to great books on headphones while they're out in the field working. Maybe they could get, an apprenticeship at a John Deere plant. And then in the evenings, they could have a private tutor. So what she's saying is that there's no plan for brick and mortar schools. There's no need for that. Kids are going to be in the fields anyway. They could provide free apprenticeships for, John Deere, which it's 2 hours away from me, the nearest one, and then rely on private tutors. So they're saying what they mean.
Now, I remember years ago when I was in college, I'd done a research paper. And I came across a quote and I can't find it anymore. A CEO said sometimes kids are spoiled with too much education. That if they're too smart, they're not going to do the menial, manual, dangerous jobs. So we have to keep them, at a certain level of competency and education, or they'll think they're too good for it. And I listened to what you just said from Betsy DeVos, and that rings so in line with statements of 150 years ago.
It does. I mean, you know, it's the gilded age all over again. It's children giving them coffee and a cigarette and sending them into the mines. And that's not hyperbole. Like, that literally happened. You know, if you read your history, that's exactly what happened. Moms who, you know, their husbands left or their husbands died or whatever happened, these kids are going to work. Yeah. They need to help provide for their family. And I would say this, too. I hear from people, even like my mom, who is a Republican, I would say, you know, I paid for my college education. She's an RN. And I was like, it was $32.
Yeah.
A credit hour, mom, $32. Even if we, you know, look at that with inflation, it's not $3,000, right?
Not $3,000. No. The community college where I know people go is like 12 grand a year. You go to the exclusive school in my neighborhood, like 60 grand a year.
I hear people talking about, well, I just have, you know, a state level education. I was like, that is $120,000 now, right? I mean, you think about people like me. We had one son who is now a teacher who had to get his brains hit every single day to play football so that he could get a scholarship so he could go. My other son carries a rifle for the U.S. Army so that he can afford to go to school. There are people like me who cannot really, you know, give much to their kids to do this. And so our kids are really, that's why it makes me so mad about the loan repayment when people are like, we're paying off Ivy League. No, you're not. You're paying off the teacher who makes $35,000 a year. You're helping them make their payments. You know, it's outrageous.
Yeah. Now, in looking at this Project 2025, there's some things in there. You brought up the school choice thing, the vouchers. And you look, you know, on the school choice front, what's interesting to me is, you know, the choices I get are bad and worse. I want the choice of a really good local public school that's well-funded, well-resourced, and class sizes that are manageable. That's what I would like to have. We used to have that in this country. And then these folks who want alternate systems so that they can put their hands in the pot and line their pockets, they seem to have screwed that up. But outside of, you know, eliminating the Department of Education because the federal government's bad, you know, school choice and deregulation, you know, what else is in this monstrosity?
Indoctrination. You know, they want kids to be indoctrinated. They talk about, you know, teachers like me indoctrinating kids with real history. They want the literal Bible taught in there. Ryan Walters out of Oklahoma has mandated that they teach the Bible. And I'm going to say that's real dangerous. Mandate someone like me to teach the Bible. Do it. I'll do it. It'll be fun, right? We're going to have a great time teaching this.
Banned? I mean, you know, the porn, the violence, all that stuff, shouldn't that be banned?
You'd think the slavery, all the things, right, that they don't want to talk about. But they forget that public educators are well qualified and highly educated, and you're not dealing. And that's another thing, too, when people talk about, well, I wish that my kid could get into a really, you know, good private school. Your kid's not going to get into that because they're going to make that higher than the voucher. My kid, they don't want my kid in there. My kid is going to get a voucher to go to the local Baptist church and sit in the basement with people who don't have degrees behind them, handing them worksheets and maybe a computer every now and then, or playing, you know, making the Pizza Hut into, you know, some sort of school. This is what school choice looks like. And it's all about grifting. It's 100% about grifting. The people that are pushing really hard to privatize schools in Missouri, there's a group, they're called the Herzog Foundation, and their entire goal is to catalyze Christian education. Well, guess who is on the advisory board for the Heritage 2025 plan? The Herzog Foundation. That's weird, right? That's weird.
No, it's predictable because it's not just there. It's all across the country where these people, they know how to line their pockets. And look, the charter school thing is part of that as well. You know, when Albert Shanker came up with the idea of trying things a little bit differently, having kids be able to learn in different environments, and it to be a public school where best practices were shared, he never envisioned that the curriculum would be proprietary and you'd have to buy it back after you developed it. They never imagined that you would have an entire board system outside of the public realm. But that's what it's morphed into, because it really is all about the money, isn't it?
It is. And it's about segregation as well. And so if you're talking about charter schools and what happens when you create, you dislodge the public schools and create charter school systems, look at Louisiana. After Hurricane Katrina, they took away all public school and they turned it into a, you know, charter environment. Do we want our schools to look like what's happening in New Orleans? Probably not, because it is an absolute failure. And now people spend so much of their time trying to get into the right charters. There's a whole organization that has cropped up to help people find out which charter is best and then try their best to get into the best charters. When you were saying, we used to have a community school where we knew our teachers, they were educated at, you know, the public universities, and now they're teaching our kids and they're trying to get rid of that.
No, and the whole idea, you know, again, you have to ask, what's the end game here? So let me throw it out as a question. What is the end game then? I mean, I have a theory, but I'm curious, you know, because I listen to a lot of my friends who are like, well, you know, why would they do X? You know, we want to have our kids get the best education. They got one shot at getting the best opportunity on the best education they can get. Why would someone want to destroy that? So what do you think the end game is? Is it something nefarious? Is it the road, you know, with good intentions? Where do you put this at?
I need a tinfoil hat right now. But, you know, I'm not into conspiracy theories, but I know who wrote Project 2025, and those are billionaires. And if we have ever thought for one second that the billionaires were concerned about us or our children, we need to rethink that. These people have been pissed since FDR. They have been angry that they have to pay for schools that their children don't attend, and they don't care if our children attend, because it makes it more difficult to get workers, right? When everyone is well educated, they're going to have to pay people more, they're going to have to change the system. Capitalism is like, you know. So a lot of this is nefarious. A lot of this is the billionaires creating the world that they want. They want an oligarchy, and this is how they plan to get it.
Yeah, so you're right in line with where I'm at. The end game's money, power, control, and of course, obviously, the cheap labor that they're addicted to. So the question then comes back to, you know, as you're looking at this manifesto that they've put out, look, everybody doesn't have time to read all 900 pages. What does the average voter do? What do we take from this? And how do Democrats use this in a way to educate? Because there are two very different policy positions, two different avenues to go. This should come down to an actual education process.
Yeah, I think it's up to people who have stakes. Like, I can read the 44 pages on education and I can disseminate that and send that out. You can read the pages on labor. You can disseminate that and send that out. So it's going to take experts who can look at each one of these sections and say, this is what it's about. This is what they're planning to do. There is nothing in this plan that is good or hopeful for my neighbors or my community. I can't find anything in there that is going to make rent less expensive, you know, raise wages, make sure that our children are educated, make sure that they have access to health care. So it is anti-democratic at its heart. And we need to look at people to start disseminating that information. You're right. Who has time for 900 pages? We're working two jobs, right?
No, absolutely. I mean, we're working harder and harder, and we see a lot of us seem to be falling behind. And, you know, the idea that while we work hard, we want our kids to have a better opportunity. And again, my fear is, as I'm watching this political theater at the RNC and I'm reading through this manifesto, this Project 2025, I don't have high hopes for the future. I'm fearful for my children and their children, as the conservative ideology that they've been honest about, that they shoved down our throats and take us back to the good old days of the 80s and 90s and not the 1980s and 90s.
Yeah, when we had funded schools. When I think about the election, I'm fearful too. And this is what scares me the most, is those, the SCOTUS judges, we see them making decisions for all of us now. They took away bodily autonomy from every woman, you know, in this country. And I'm very fearful that with another Trump presidency, we get two new judges for Alito and Thomas, and we won't vote again. And that's the end of our free and fair elections. And I know that sounds insane to say it out loud, but those are the things that keep me up at night.
We got a lot of work to do. So, last question: what should people be doing? How do we stay up on this? What are you asking, folks?
What I know that people need to be doing is talking to their neighbors, knocking doors, making sure that Democratic, lawmakers are able to be elected. Me walking across the street and talking to my neighbor Fern is going to make a big difference, because she's probably never heard of Project 2025, right? And that's why we need candidates everywhere, people that are talking to people everywhere. We all need to understand this. By the way, Facebook is starting to flag posts on Project 2025 and Christian nationalism. So, and which wouldn't be super problematic if a lot of people didn't get their news from those spaces, right? So we're really getting into a 2016 sort of issue. You need to talk to your neighbors. You need to talk to real folks.
Yeah, ultimately it's face-to-face stuff, you know. Mm-hmm. Enough with the Facebook. It's getting into the bars and in the churches and you know, having those knockdown drag out, you know, what I consider fun conversations. It's where we got to go. But Jess Piper, I appreciate you taking time for us. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
I want to hear your thoughts. Email me, rick@therickssmithshow.com. I want to thank Jess Piper, Executive Director of Blue Missouri, for sharing some thoughts. I'm going to take a quick break. Back after this. Stick around.
You're listening to locally grown radio, WFHR, Tome for the Todd Allball Show.
Local radio for you and your community. It's Civic Media's mission with stations across Wisconsin. Find your favorites at civicmedia.us.
I'm meteorologist Mace Michaels. Mostly clear for tonight, a low in the mid-50s. Mostly sunny for tomorrow, a high in the mid-70s. And upper 70s with more sunshine Thursday. Mostly sunny and upper 70s to near 80 by Friday. Saturday and Sunday, a slight chance of showers, highs close to 80. Currently, it's 66.
To everyone looking to make mealtime more special, our team member Joel is here to celebrate the Culver's fan favorite.
Our limited-time Pretzel House Pub Burger is back. Two kinds of melty Wisconsin cheddar cheese, fresh beef, or thick-cut bacon, all served on a soft pretzel roll. This Pub Burger has Wisconsin in every bite.
Stop by Culver's for a handcrafted favorite.
From Wisconsin with love.
Welcome to Delicious.
Culver's, 8th Street South, Wisconsin Rapids.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So, spending a little time with the Project 2025 900-page manifesto. And interesting, there's a little bit in there about CAFE standards. Look, you got to give them credit. They are detail-oriented. They are going after every facet of government and every regulation and every rule and every law. Look, they pay those guys really good to come up with really bad ideas. But this one is, they've got to destroy the CAFE standards. And I guess that's so people will buy gas guzzlers, so that there really isn't a stick to say don't buy them, or, you know, because we want to move to electric vehicles. And then they're going to gut the subsidies for electric vehicles. And as I said, I guess the argument is Americans have a right to gas guzzlers, and it's their goal to defend that right, I guess. But here to share some thoughts on, you know, where this takes the new manufacturing, where this takes the next generation of technology and the jobs that come with that, I've asked our good friend Scott Paul to come talk with us. Scott's the president of the Alliance for American Manufacturing, AmericanManufacturing.org, the website. Scott, thanks for taking time for us.
Hey, Rick, it is great to be with you as always.
So Project 2025 is the buzz for everyone. I've got a bunch of friends saying it's the end of democracy. I've got a bunch of friends saying this is going to create the imperial president. And I got a bunch of people who are saying, look, this is just the destruction of the administrative state and basically handing power over to the rich and powerful. Any thoughts on this CAFE standard thing and all of that?
Wow. Yeah. On issues like CAFE standards that help to drive new investment in manufacturing in the United States, I think it's important to understand the dynamics and how our automakers and auto workers have adapted to CAFE standards, which, you know, the fuel economy for a given automaker's fleet. And there's a couple of things that CAFE standards do. They drive innovation, number one. Number two, for people who care about clean energy, they get us closer to outcomes that are aligned with that. Number three, they ensure that the United States is in the game in a wide variety of auto production, both internal combustion engine, electric vehicle, other alternate fuel vehicles, and hybrids, and provide a diverse array of auto choices from sedans on the way up to, you know, your, you know, eight-seater SUVs. So the idea that you want to scrap something that has kind of fueled some innovation and choice for consumers and has kept the United States in this game seems to me to be really counterproductive. And I think this is an important but for, you know, if you're a fossil fuel interests and you're solely focused on how well fossil fuel companies are doing, then it's probably think it's a good idea, right? But for everybody else, there's not a lot of upside. And I'll just say this, you know, people are buying more hybrid and electric vehicles, and that's just a fact, with or without government intervention. That is happening. It was happening before. It's happening during. It will continue to happen. And the only question is the rate of that change and who's going to be manufacturing those vehicles.
Correct.
And so if we take our foot out of that game, we're going to lose out on the fastest growing market globally for types of mobility, you know, those that are hybrid or clean energy. So that seems to me to be really, really foolish, Rick.
Yeah, but here's the thing. And the reason I bring this up to you, Scott, is, you know, early in the program, I talked about Steve Forbes. And, you know, Steve Forbes, a billionaire, went on to say that, you know, the old socialism is dead. The old socialism of, you know, people wanting to own the factors of production and government to own everything, that's gone. The new socialism, he said, was that we're just going to regulate everything. We're going to put standards in place. We're going to do all of the things that you and I think might agree on that are good for, you know, worker safety, consumer safety, for the planet, for the country, even, I would argue, even for employers. But there's this new push to deregulate everything and return us to an era that really never was a kind of a wild, wild west of, the free invisible hand market. I'm curious of your thoughts on Steve Forbes' comment.
Sounds like the dude needs to read a little Upton Sinclair to me.
I'm sure he's read Upton Sinclair's book and go, yeah, I'm okay with that, because he knows which side he's on.
Right. Yeah. I mean, that's not a race to the bottom is not a race that the United States wants to win or can win. Right. Because no matter what the goals of a deregulatory frenzy are, there's always going to be another country out there that is less democratic or more willing to exploit people that's going to try to do that. And the only thing that we're doing is making workers poorer, making the environment worse off, and making workplaces less safe. And so that to me seems to be not the right path. And I'm just going to say this. If you know, other than China, which obviously infuses trillions of dollars into its industrial sector to aid in its competitiveness, the economies around the world that are manufacturing powerhouses do it with unions. They do it on the high road. They do it with public investment. They do it in a regulatory environment that shapes markets and creates market opportunities. And they do it with regulations like Buy America, for instance. And so the Steve Forbes methodology. Look, we've tried a lot of that before, lowering taxes, cutting back on regulation, and doing free trade. And it got us deeper trade deficits. It got us fewer manufacturing jobs. And it depressed real wages. So, I mean, we've seen this, and it doesn't work. So he's just kind of out of step. And I'm just going to add this on, you know, on some of his policies, he's out of step with Republican voters now, who I think have a share a distrust of big corporations, tend to be more populist on issues like industrial policy and trade policy and tariffs, for instance. So he's fighting a battle from, you know, the last millennium, and it's not the future of any philosophy in the United States, or at least I hope it's not, Rick.
Yeah, I'm with you. Since you brought up tariffs, I mean, I just saw a story that, you know, we're back to record trade deficits with China. And something has got to be done. And look, both parties finally realize that we've gone too far down this road, and something has to be done. And look, I agreed with President Trump when he said they were going to put tariffs on things. I wish there was a plan to follow up on that. I agreed with President Biden to keep it and to move forward to trying to get the rest of the world on board. But this is clearly going to be a continuing issue, regardless of who's president in 2025. And I know Project 2025 is on all sides and everywhere on this issue. Can you talk a little bit about where you see the environment right now for tariffs and taking on China as we move into the next year?
Yeah, that's a really good point. And so we still do have a record goods trade deficit globally. It's about $1 trillion a year now, which is just astounding. With China, it's leveling off. It's going down according to the official data. But then a lot of that's coming through other countries. A lot of that's coming through this loophole called de minimis, which we've talked about. And so it probably undercounts what's happening with China. But the reality of this is that one of the tools in the toolbox that we have to deal with this is tariffs. And to Trump's credit, he put some tariffs on in his first term. To Biden's great credit, I think, he enhanced those tariffs. He enlisted allies to do the same thing, which I think is important. And he's backed that up with investments domestically. And so I think any policy that reverses the tariffs, is not going to be popular with voters. First of all, we know this because we polled on this, and Republican, Independent, Democratic voters all think that you know, tariffs are at least stabilized, or higher tariffs on product coming from China are a good thing. But here's the rub. If there is a party in power that is friendly to the Business Roundtable and to the Chamber of Commerce and to the Heritage Foundation and all those other kind of interest groups that have an interest in that Project 2025, then cutting those tariffs is going to be on the agenda. And you still see it pop up with some Republican members of Congress who want to do that, and who want more free trade agreements, who want less tariffs on Chinese products. But I'd like to think that they're the outliers, but the money backing all of that stuff is really powerful, as you know. And so I think we have to take that threat very seriously.
You know, I get a lot of comments from people because, again, I've been very clear in my support for using tariffs in a strategic manner. But the response I always get, and this is from both sides of the political aisle, that you're just raising prices and it's hurting consumers, it's hurting inflation. And the way to undo the harmful effects of inflation is to open up the borders, let all this stuff come in so we can get cheaper stuff, Scott, because we need cheap stuff.
Yeah. Well, here's the truth. You know, most of the inflation that happened, almost all of it, during the pandemic and in the aftermath, none of that was related to tariffs at all. It was related to actually having far-flung supply chains that got disrupted and created shortages, right? So it was the opposite of that. And when you're reshoring more stuff, no doubt there is some upfront expense, and that's part of what industrial policy is trying to offset, because moving capital intensive goods is not free. It does take a little bit of resources, but ultimately the more competition you have, the more localized the supply chains, then you can control them and mitigate against risks. The better off the consumer is going to be, the more choices the consumer will have, and the less upward pressure on prices. And so ultimately, tariffs, if utilized with other tools in the toolbox, are not going to be inflationary. And so I do think we have to be careful if we're talking about things that we only import, and particularly for working poor families, and I'm thinking of food and other things like that. And again, there are some exceptions to that, but you know, the idea that overall that tariffs were the cause of inflation is just, I don't even think someone like Paul Krugman supports that. It's gasoline, fuel, housing prices because of just the availability of housing or interest rates. It has nothing to do with the tariffs that have been established on a variety of products.
Right? Yeah, and let's not forget corporate greed, that, you know,
absolutely
old-fashioned, yeah, American opportunism.
Yeah, yeah, and there was clearly some evidence of that. And I've often noticed this, both either with free trade agreements or with tariffs, that, you know, a company will look to a trade thing and say, well, this is the reason why I'm selling this for more money now. And when that circumstance changes, they keep the price high. They don't lower it. Right. And so it is about greed, you know, and there is a lot of that, which is why we need watchdogs to look out for that, to look out for the American consumer.
And as I keep saying, if you don't like the price of it, at some point as consumers, your power is to not buy it when you think they're gouging you. That's another way of going back. But I want to finish up because you mentioned the word de minimis here a minute ago. And oddly enough, Prime Day on Amazon. And that's, I guess, a big thing. It's the day that I absolutely refuse to ever buy anything from Amazon. But a lot of people do. But, yeah, you know, we talked about this, I think, last week or the week before, that, you know, Amazon is moving towards the Temu and Shein and this kind of store where you can buy direct from China. You want to talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, I do. And it's one of those, if you can't beat them, join them. And first, Amazon did it because of the competition they faced from Alibaba, which was a Chinese kind of like marketplace like Amazon. And so Amazon began offering Chinese sellers direct access to the Amazon platform, but that wasn't good enough, Rick. Now they're like, we're going to let them ship directly from China, and to avoid the tariffs, which is called this de minimis loophole, which has to be stopped, because it's actually like, you know, it makes Target, Walmart, other retailers look like the good guys here, because they're actually paying the tariffs on this stuff if they're importing them. And Walmart and Shein and Temu and these other companies won't be. Amazon, yeah, Shein and Temu won't be, because Amazon has kind of like joined this, let's ship it directly from China and skip the inspections and the tariffs. And I think that's important too, because the de minimis loophole has been an important conduit for illegal shipments of fentanyl and other things coming in the United States. So we got to stop it. There is legislation, you know, Earl Blumenauer, Democrat from Oregon, has some. There's some bipartisan support for it, but we got to get it across the finish line.
Yeah. So what you're talking about is you're all in favor of Steve Forbes' new socialism, you know, inspections, basic rules to access to our markets, you know, that overregulation stuff. Is that what you're telling me?
Yeah, I'll tell you what I'm for. I'm for just having a level of decency for American workers, and to make sure that no one is being exploited. That's what I'm for, but it doesn't sound like everybody is there.
There you go. Scott Paul, appreciate the time. As always, good stuff.
All right. Thanks, Rick. Great to be with you.
Good stuff. Our good friend Scott Paul, president of the Alliance for American Manufacturing, AmericanManufacturing.org. Check out the website. Want to hear your thoughts, that Prime thing. You joining me on the, I'm not buying there. I want to hear your thoughts. Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Going to take a quick break. Right back. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. this day in labor history, the year was 1862. That was the day that black rights activist Ida B. Wells Barnett was born in Holly Springs, Mississippi. She was the oldest of eight children. Wells went to college and then became a teacher in Memphis, Tennessee. While in Memphis, Ida B. Wells became active in speaking out against black oppression in the Jim Crow South. She was the editor of a black newspaper, The Free Speech and Headlight. She wrote about many of the issues that faced the black community, including violence, unequal education facilities, and voter suppression. Taking such a public stand could have disastrous repercussions. She wrote under the pseudonym Iola, but she was fired from her job for writing about the inequities of the segregated Southern education system. Tom Moss, a successful black store owner and friend of Ida B. Wells, was lynched by a white mob. Two other black men were also lynched for helping him to try and defend his store. Black Southern business owners were seen as potential economic competition and were often the targets of threats, violence, and lynching. Angered by the murders, Ida B. Wells began to research the lynchings. She published the findings of her investigation in her newspaper. Furious white residents destroyed and burned her newspaper office. In danger for her life, Wells left Memphis. Ida moved to Chicago, where she continued her anti-lynching work, documenting how the heinous act happened not only in the South. She helped to found the NAACP. At the first NAACP conference in Atlanta in 1909, Wells spoke, saying, quote, "Time was when lynching appeared to be sectional, but now it is national. A blight upon our nation, mocking our laws, and disgracing our Christianity." Like what you hear? Check out more at laborhistoryin2.com.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
Now, it's interesting reading through the Project 2025 manifesto. It's one of these things where, you know, as we were talking with Scott Paul about the next generation of manufacturing, the jobs that will be lost by these policies being implemented, and looking back to the past for the bad ideas, they advocate more trade deals, more free trade. And one of the things that caught my attention as I was reading through it was talking about trade adjustment assistance. And I know it's one of these little technical weird things that only someone like me would go, that's kind of important. It is not the law of the land anymore, because there are supposedly no more jobs lost due to trade. So it's been eliminated. But in those moments where we passed free trade agreements, it was in there as a way to soften the blow for people who lost their jobs. Because, look, when they pass these things, they know Americans are going to lose jobs. So to kind of lessen the blow, they have come out with policies to help people who are displaced, are fired, laid off, lost their jobs, to find other employment, to be able to make that transition. And I found it interesting that in Project 2025's in pages, they talk about trade adjustment assistance and that it's popular policy for aiding displaced workers. Though flawed, they say, it is a bargaining tool that can potentially help to get sound trade policy adopted, because they're all in on free trade. A conservative administration should approach trade adjustment assistance with caution and use it as a last resort political bargaining tool and not a first resort policy. Now, understand what they're saying here is, we don't care about you. We don't care when you lose your job. We don't care that you're going to get any help. No, it's not going to happen. And why don't they like it? Well, what they said is funding for job training programs and the like will typically find its way to labor union slush funds, left-leaning nonprofits, and other progressive causes that will not necessarily help displaced workers. Now, that's ridiculous, because trade adjustment assistance is for educational programs. They'll get you into the community college, a voc-tech program. They'll get you into places to help you get the skills that you need to find something else. It extends unemployment a little bit. There's some things in there that go to the worker to help them get through it. This idea that, well, we're against it because it's going to help those evil others. It's ridiculous. But again, it's the selling point. Now, they argue a better approach to trade adjustment assistance, if it must be expanded, is direct cash transfers. And why? Because they believe trade adjustment assistance should treat workers who lose their jobs to international trade the same way that any worker does. The same way workers who lose their jobs for any other reason are treated, which is you're on your own. And this, again, for me, is another one of these moments where I go, look at what they're saying. We're watching the Republicans try and moderate themselves a little bit. We're watching them, look, we care about workers. They brought Sean O'Brien out to say, look, we've got some union support. We care about workers. And it's what they write. It's what they say. It's what they do that I think is important. And pointing out this one little thing. And we're going to be picking parts out of this from now till election time. It is over 900 pages long of the things that they want to change to swing the pendulum from working people to the very, very wealthy. And I know, look, I've had a bunch of people say, well, you should give Sean O'Brien a break for going and talking to the Republicans because we got to talk to everybody. And I agree with that generally, except for people who have stated that they want to destroy you, except people who have shown us time and time and time again that they want to destroy us, that they want to destroy that standard of living that our grandparents fought for, that they want to destroy that opportunity for ourselves and our children. They've shown us in their policies, in what they do, and that's my problem. This is but one more part of this. They are very clear. They want to destroy collective bargaining. They want to bring back company unions, like I said earlier. This is about the pendulum swinging to the wealthy and the powerful. And you got to give them credit. They're very honest about it. They wrote it out for everyone to go look at. The sad reality is they know we're not going to look at it. And as we talked about with Jess Piper earlier in the program, they want to privatize and profitize education. They want to do to K-12 education what they've done to higher ed. They want to do to every facet of our lives like they've done to prisons, like they've done to our turnpikes, like they've done to parking authorities across the country, as they've privatized, profitized, and of course, minimized our ability to use and get good services, it's made them wealthier. That's what this is about. So when I come on and I say, look, the reality is, and they're telling us, this is about more for them, less for us. This is about creating that environment of division where we basically eat ourselves, where we're fighting over the nonsense while not fighting over common sense. They are telling us what they want to do. They are telling us how they want to do it. They want to fire every federal worker and replace him with good old-fashioned patronage hires. They're telling us that. They're telling us that they want to crush the ability of workers to organize. They're telling us what their agenda is. The question is, will we listen? Now, I don't think I'm wrong when I say they want to take us back to the good old days of the 80s and 90s, and not the 1980s and 90s. The 1980s still had 20-25% union density in this country. Unlike the 1890s, where it was in most places illegal to be a union member. They would take you out back and do terrible things. They would hang labor organizers from railroad trestles. So the question becomes, when do we as working people wake up to the reality that we are under attack? And that in this moment, the guy who has been fighting for us these last 4 years against the horrible policies of the previous 4 years before that, it seems like a simple choice to me. But I keep getting the, well, you know, Rick, you got to do your research. Check out this YouTube video. I can't tell you how many times I have gotten that email. And I'm sorry, but watching a YouTube video isn't doing your research. Sorry, Bubba. Anyway, if you missed any portion of today's program, make sure you grab the podcast. Wherever you find your favorite podcast, you'll find ours. Our video over at freespeech.org. Make sure you check out that. And if you've got something to say, you're something on your mind, rick@thericksmithshow.com.
Email Rick. Rick@thericksmithshow.com. This is locally grown radio. WFHR 1320 AM. W248DE Wisconsin Rapids. And always streaming on the Civic Media app.